Welcome to the Security Nexus Deep Dive. We're a Maryland-based national security consultancy, the Security Nexus, and our mission is really to provide strategic advisory, education, and, well, actionable knowledge on today's threats. If you like what you hear today and want more, please check us out at thesecuritynexus.net. So today we're diving into something pretty complex. It's this paradox, really, right at the heart of cyber insurance, a multi-billion dollar question mark.
That's right. It's about how we handle catastrophic cyber events, you know, the kind that might blur the lines between massive crime and, well, an act of war.
Exactly. Cyber insurance is meant to transfer risk. You pay a premium, the insurer takes the financial hit if disaster strikes. But what happens when that disaster is potentially state-sponsored, massive, coordinated?
And that's where this war exclusion clause comes in. It's a standard bit of text in many policies, but its meaning in the cyber context is causing huge headaches.
We've been digging into some really insightful work here, pulling from scholars like Josephine Wolf, Daniel Arce, Rainer Burma, Daniel Woods.
Yeah, and others, yeah. Our pal, Minyan Liu, Frank Creamer, Barry Sheehan, Martin Mullins. A lot of smart people looking at this. They show how this uncertainty, especially around the definition of war, affects everyone, attackers and defenders.
It's fascinating because, as the sources point out, the insurance industry is effectively defining these terms faster than governments are. Billions are on the line based on how they interpret hostile or warlike action.
Which dramatically shifts who pays for modern conflict, doesn't it?
It really does. Okay, so let's start where cyber insurance actually works quite well. On the micro level, right after a company gets hit.
Yeah, incident response or IR. This is kind of the success story. While insurers sometimes struggle to, you know, get policyholders to boost their preventative security.
Right, like patching systems.
Yeah.
It's hard to enforce that effectively from the outside.
Exactly. But once a breach happens, the insurance mechanism kicks in beautifully with these IR services.
So you get hacked, you call your insurer, and what happens? They don't just cut a check, right?
No, not at all. They activate what's called an IR panel. It's a pre-approved team lawyers, digital forensics experts, data recovery specialists, even PR folks sometimes.
That sounds incredibly valuable, especially for a smaller company that wouldn't have those kinds of experts on speed dial.
No, absolutely. For many companies, accessing that level of coordinated expertise quickly would be almost impossible, or at least prohibitively expensive, without the insurance policy.
So the insurer isn't just paying out claims, they're actively managing the cleanup. And the sources called this part of the policy an incomplete contract. What does that mean here?
It's an interesting point. It means the policy doesn't spell out exactly which specific IR provider you'll get beforehand. Think about your car insurance.
Mm-hmm.
You might have a list of approved repair shops you can choose from.
Okay.
Here, the insurer usually dictates the IR team. And crucially, if you decide to go outside that panel, maybe hire your own IT consultant, the insurer probably won't reimburse you for those costs.
Why that restriction? Why not let the policyholder choose?
It comes down to managing risk, specifically something called moral hazard.
Okay, moral hazard. That's when you take more risks because someone else bears the cost, right?
Precisely. If you knew the insurer would pay for any cleanup crew you hired, you might be tempted to pick a cheaper, maybe less thorough option to save hassle up front.
I see. And then the insurer ends up paying more down the line if the cleanup isn't done properly and there's another incident.
Exactly. So by controlling the IR panel, using teams they know and trust and whose performance they can monitor over time,
they ensure a certain quality of response.
Right. They can achieve a higher standard of incident response than maybe the policyholder would choose on their own. So for individual incidents, this model, insurer control over IR, works really well. It manages that immediate chaos effectively.
Okay, so micro-level risk handled. But then we zoom out. We look at the big picture, the systemic risk, and things get shaky, especially when we talk about reinsurance.
Yeah, the scale is huge, first off. You mentioned billions in one. The U.S. market alone was over $7 billion in direct written premium in 2022. Globally, maybe $14 billion.
Wow.
And a huge chunk of that risk, maybe up to 45%, gets passed on to reinsurers, the companies that insure the insurers.
And they're the ones really worried about the big one, the catastrophic cyber event.
Absolutely terrified.
Yeah.
They deal with the long tail risks, these low probability, high impact events,
yeah,
less than 5% chance of happening.
But incredibly damaging if they do.
Exactly. And the problem is they're incredibly hard to model. The sources mention significant divergence between the different risk models the vendors use. They can't even agree on how likely a massive coordinated loss actually is.
Wait, if the market is $14 billion globally, why can't they just pool that risk like they do for, say, house fires?
Because of the fear of correlated losses. Insurance works because risk is diversified. Not everyone's house burns down simultaneously. But a major cyber attack, one that exploits a vulnerability in widely used software or critical infrastructure, that could hit potentially all of an insurer's clients at the same time. Banks, manufacturers, hospitals, everyone.
So the diversification breaks down. The whole principle of risk sharing collapses if everyone makes a claim at once.
Correct. A reinsurer just can't build a diverse enough portfolio to protect against that kind of synchronized event in the cyber realm.
So traditional reinsurance isn't always the best fit for these huge systemic cyber risks.
It struggles. And this instability forces insurers to look elsewhere for capital, for ways to offload this catastrophic risk. That's where things like insurance-linked securities, ILS, come in.
ILS catastrophe bonds, right. We hear about those for things like hurricanes.
Same idea, basically. They bundle up the risk of a specific catastrophic cyber event, like a massive grid outage caused by hackers, and sell it as a bond to investors in the capital markets.
So hedge funds, pension funds.
Yet investors willing to bet that the catastrophe won't happen. They get a high return if things stay calm, but they lose their investment if the trigger event occurs.
It brings more money to the table, but it sounds, well, maybe a bit fragile. Relying on external capital markets instead of the insurance industry managing the risk itself.
It is a concern, and the sources are quite clear on this. The fact that the market struggles to create stable reinsurance for these catastrophic cyber events is a major vulnerability for our network societies.
And they actually call for government intervention.
Some do, yes. They argue this market instability strongly calls for centralized government regulatory action or some kind of intervention to help promote better risk-sharing mechanisms. Because relying solely on catastrophe bonds might not be sustainable long-term.
Okay, which brings us right back to that ticking time bomb, the war exclusion clause. You said insurers are defining war in cyberspace faster than governments.
They almost have to, right? Their definitions are driven by financial necessity. Figuring out what kind of massive interconnected loss is just too big to cover. And these commercial definitions are effectively becoming policy now.
They could end up shaping how governments eventually define cyber conflict norms.
It's very likely.
Right.
Because these definitions have immediate multi-billion dollar consequences. And the event that really forced this issue, that blew the doors off, was NotPetya in June 2017.
Ah, yes, NotPetya. That wasn't just an attack. It felt like the attack that showed what systemic cyber catastrophe looked like.
It was devastating. Attributed by both the U.S. and U.K. governments to the Russian military, it used the Eternal Blue exploit.
Which was stolen from the NSA, ironically.
Right. And it spread globally incredibly fast, initially through Ukrainian accounting software called Medoc. But it didn't stay in Ukraine.
No, it hit huge multinational companies. Tell us about the impact.
It was chaos. Maersk, the giant shipping company, had its global operations crippled, cost them hundreds of millions.
Mm-hmm.
Mondelez, the food company, huge losses. But the landmark case, the one everyone talks about, is Merck, the pharmaceutical giant.
What happened to Merck?
Billions in damages. Mm. Production halted, research disrupted, just a massive operational hit.
So Merck, Mondelez, they file their insurance claims.
And bang.
Yeah.
Denied. The insurers pointed straight to that old war exclusion clause. Hostile or warlike action in time of peace or war by a government or sovereign power.
Okay, now here's the interesting part. Usually, attribution in cyber attacks is murky, right? It's hard to prove who did it.
Very hard.
But here, you had the U.S. and U.K. governments publicly blaming the Russian military. Didn't that make the insurers' case for them? Saying, see? Government attribution. It's warlike action.
You'd think so. It seemed like the perfect setup for the insurers. But the legal battle that followed, particularly the Merck case, showed it wasn't that simple. Government say-so wasn't enough. The actual language of the contract was paramount.
Right, the Merck ruling. That came down in 2021, upheld later. What did the court decide?
The court sided with Merck against the insurer. Judge Thomas J. Walsh ruled that the traditional war exclusion, as written, did not apply to the NotPetya attack.
Why not, if a government was blamed for launching it?
The judge focused on the history and reasonable interpretation of that clause. He said Merck's reasonable understanding of this exclusion involved the use of armed forces, physical, kinetic warfare.
Ah, so language drafted thinking about tanks and bombs, basically, maybe after World War I or World War II.
Exactly. The court noted the attack hit a private non-combatant company, Merck, and was wholly outside the context of any armed conflict or military objective in the traditional sense.
So the court basically said to the insurers, look, we don't really care that the White House blamed Russia. Your contract language is old. It was meant for conventional war. If you wanted it to cover state-sponsored cyber attacks against civilian companies, you needed to update it. You didn't.
That's the core message. The court was, as one source put it, distinctly uninterested in the government attribution aspect. It focused purely on the nature of the target, a civilian company, and the lack of connection to traditional armed conflict.
That's a huge ruling. It essentially told the entire insurance industry they needed to rewrite their rule book if they wanted to exclude these kinds of attacks.
It was a mandate. Be explicit. Define clearly what kind of cyber event is not covered.
And how has the market responded since then? Are they rewriting the exclusions?
Oh, yes. Aggressively. They're broadening the language, trying to be much more specific about what constitutes an uninsurable state-backed cyber operation.
Going beyond just the intended target.
Exactly. They learned from NotPetya that the unintended collateral damage is often the most catastrophic part. So now underwriters are being asked to specify things like whether the policy excludes damage to computer systems located outside the country, primarily targeted by the state actor.
Wow. So they're trying to wall off the risk of global spillover, defining uninsurable cyber war with incredible precision.
Yes, often requiring complex certifications about the attacker's identity and motive, sometimes from independent third parties. It's getting very granular.
Which means the definition of what counts as an act of war, at least for insurance payout purposes, is expanding, dictated by financial liability, not international law.
And think about the implications for deterrence if insurance for major state-backed attacks becomes unavailable or just way too expensive.
The risk just snaps back onto the companies themselves.
Right. Or it puts pressure on governments to create some kind of financial backstop. But the terms of that backstop might end up being heavily influenced by these new, stricter definitions the insurance industry is creating.
Okay, let's try to pull this all together. It seems cyber insurance works really well for managing the internal risk of individual breaches, using tools like those IR panels to handle moral hazard.
Yeah, the micro-level stuff, it's got a good handle on that.
But the moment you scale up to catastrophic external risk, especially state-backed attacks, the system gets fragile. The war exclusion clause, the difficulty for reinsurers to handle correlated losses. It exposes major vulnerabilities.
And NotPetya was the shock that forced everyone to realize the old language, the old assumptions, just weren't fit for the cyber age.
It really forced a reckoning.
Absolutely. And this whole ongoing debate, this struggle to define warlike action in cyberspace for financial purposes, it leaves us with a really critical question. And this is something for you, the listener, to think about.
Okay, what's the final thought?
If insurers manage to successfully write exclusions that carve out damage from the most sophisticated state-backed cyber attacks, does cyber insurance then stop being a key tool for economic resilience against all major threats? Does it inadvertently become this market force that dictates, simply by deciding who pays, which kinds of cyber attacks we, as a society, officially consider to be acts of war?
That's a powerful question. Does the insurance market end up defining the terms of modern conflict? Something to definitely ponder. Thank you for joining us on the Security Nexus Deep Dive. We hope this exploration was valuable. For more analysis, please visit us at thesecuritynexus.net.